Daryl Shep is a senior vice president for neuroscience at Merck and a leading expert on drug discovery in the nervous system. As head of Merck's neuroscience franchise, he has overall responsibility for drug discovery in the field of neuroscience. He's also a member of the executive team for Merck Research Laboratories, and so is involved in setting the overall research strategy for all therapeutic areas within the company. Before he joined Merck in 2007, he was at Eli Lilly for 20 years, initially as a pharmacologist in the neuroscience research division, and later as vice president for neuroscience discovery. Most recently, Dr. Shep is perhaps best known for his work on metabotropic glutamate receptors as a drug target. In 2007, he and his colleagues reported the first successful phase 2 clinical trial for an mGluR2/3 agonist to treat schizophrenia. This was a really big deal in the field of psychiatric research. It was widely reported in the popular press, and it's especially significant because it was its first in-class drug, something that's really rare in the field of psychiatry, where the vast majority of drugs are based on principles that were discovered decades ago, and frequently these principles are not linked to the underlying biological mechanisms, unlike Dr. Shep's work. Now, there are many reasons for slow progress in the development of new treatments, but for those of us who are involved in translational research, we are extremely excited about the rapid pace of understanding of the human brain. And I'm optimistic that it's only a matter of time with this pace of discovery that we're going to see many new treatments in the field of psychiatric research. And Dr. Shep's work really exemplifies the reason that we're so optimistic, and we're so delighted to welcome him here tonight. The title of his talk, the title I have is actually maybe slightly different than the real title, which is Rational Drug Discovery in Neuroscience, Where Will New Drugs Come From? Dr. Shep.
Thank you. It need to be a little shorter. I hope you can hear me. So that question is why we're here tonight. It's really a pleasure. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I guess I should have raised my hand. This is my first forum, too. It's a very distinguished panel, and should be an interesting evening. So what I'm going to talk about today is what I would call drug discovery in the 21st century. And I've been around long enough to see, I'm a pharmacologist by training, how really dramatic the field of neuroscience, and particularly my field of neuropharmacology, has really advanced. And I'm going to focus on that a little bit today, give you a focus on kind of how we approach things in the early days, but what it's like to do today. And the themes I'll try to bring out in this talk are, first of all, what is the problem we're trying to solve, the fundamental problem that we're trying to solve in neuroscience therapeutics? Kind of, I think there's sort of a, maybe that's the state of things now. There is a reality around drug discovery. If you've been in it for a long time and you feel the pain of drug discovery because most of your work basically leads to failure. And there is a reality around that I think we need to recognize. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time is talking about what we can do different now. And I actually think this is a fantastic time to be in the field of neuroscience. It's never been more interesting, and it's never been more promising, but it's also never been more complex. I've been fortunate to spend a lot of my research career on a specific platform called glutamate pharmacology, where I was more interested in understanding the neurotransmitter and its applications. That's an example of platform. I'll illustrate a little bit of that. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So first of all, the problem is neuroscience. You know, if you work in a pharmaceutical company and you start talking about therapeutics, and the field of neuroscience encompasses, depending on how grandly you want to get, you could list 60, 70 diseases. And in many cases, it'd be difficult to explain what all these diseases have in common. And that makes it a little different from other therapeutic areas where you invest. In fact, at Merck, my new responsibilities, neuroscience encompasses disorders of the brain, nerves, and even the eye, the retina. So we're working in ophthalmology on retinal diseases, retinal degeneration in different conditions such as diabetes, et cetera, age-induced, et cetera. I think what pulls these areas together is that the unmet medical need, the advances is uniformly high. We haven't solved that many big problems in neuroscience. So these commercial opportunities, the side opportunities, they vary from disorder, and we're going to talk about that tonight, about the road to disease progression. But in general, there's a lot left to do. There's a lot of advances that have been made. We divide neuroscience into neurology, and we divide it into psychiatry, as I've listed here, and maybe ophthalmology is back of the eye, front of the eye, like glaucoma. But there's a lot of comorbidities, basically, across these disorders. Psychiatric symptoms are very common in neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, as one example. And there may be commonalities between these disorders, between neurology and psychiatry. Okay, so the problem. So, you know, the word rational drug discovery comes out a lot. And some people say we don't do rational drug discovery in neuroscience, maybe compared to other fields. And I guess I'm going to talk about the fact I think we can begin now to do rational pharmacology. And one of the problems we have is modeling. Most neuroscience diseases are fundamentally human disorders. They involve complex, whether neurological or psychiatric, they involve complex human behavioral symptoms. That's how the nervous system, the brain in particular, manifests its symptoms, whether it's a neurodegenerative disease or a psychiatric condition. And many of these diseases that I've listed here, they're heterogeneous, so there are populations within even that condition. And then, as I mentioned, the symptoms can overlap among different disorders. Depression is common in many other types of neuroscience diseases, for example, Parkinson's, as one example. And as was mentioned already, you know, maybe compared to other areas, people would say that pathophysiology and the fundamental etiology is generally not well understood. Some people would say really not understood at all. And then the last thing is, if we try to discover drugs, we develop animal models. You know, many people question the specific disorders and the particularly novel mechanisms and how we find new drugs, because a lot of our animal models were validated with existing drugs, so it's hard to get out of that cycle. And I just thought I'd use this as an example. So this is the PANSS, this is the positive and negative syndrome scale for schizophrenia. And many drugs were launched, good drugs, were launched to treat schizophrenia using this scale. And I spent a lot of time thinking and working with this scale with my colleagues at Lilly and at Merck. And it's very interesting. It's a very interesting scale. It's very reproducible. It's very useful, and it can be used to launch drugs. When you dig into the scale, I think it tells you something about the problems I just mentioned. So you divide symptoms in schizophrenia into positive symptoms, negative symptoms, and general psychopathophysiology. And essentially, people get rated from 0 to 6 for extreme. And that's actually quite reliable instrument. And you have positive symptoms, negative symptoms, and as I mentioned, general. And essentially, you know, you could have a score of over 200 if you had a 7 on everything. But you can't have some of these positive symptoms and some of these negative symptoms at the same time. So it was actually set up to manifest a score for a heterogeneous disease, which basically, for example, you can't, you know, you have poor rapport versus, you know, grandiosity and delusions. And so it's actually a quite good instrument. But also notice, on the right-hand side, anxiety is a psychiatric disorder on its own, yet it's part of the PAN scale that represents the comorbidity. Depression, you look at G6. So, you know, schizophrenia is a heterogeneous disease, and it basically overlaps with many other conditions, psychiatric conditions and others. And what I put in the colors are basically what I've written, the red things are the things in this instrument I think you might be able to model in an animal. So you could measure excitement in an animal. You could measure hostility, maybe social withdrawal, anxiety. But that's really 6 things out of 35 things that maybe you could actually model in schizophrenia in an animal, you know, at least according to the instrument we use to approve drugs. If you look at the things in blue, Those are things that I know you can't model in an animal. Suspiciousness, basically. Difficulty in abstract thinking. That would be interesting. And lack of judgment and insight. There's a rodent symptom for you. And a poor, yeah, so basically I think that's the fundamental problem. So what do you do? I think it's really, and actually this is my dog, Billy. Like, the kids love this dog. And that is Billy. He is that same look, morning, night. His tail wags. That's the only difference. And you don't know, basically. I thought he was happy, but now I worry. Okay. He's a Labradoodle. Last time I gave this talk, I got these emails. They wanted to know what my dog was. He's a Labrador poodle. Very nice dog. Okay. I think it's interesting to go and say, how have the previous drugs been discovered? And this is actually quite sobering and also enlightening. And I think, and I'm going to talk about discovery drugs for schizophrenia, but discovery drugs for depression is just as enlightening and has some interesting other nuances. And if you want to, there's some really good, the web is great now. I found some great articles on the web on how antidepressants were discovered. And if you're interested, email me and I'll put you onto it. Looking at antipsychotics, the discovery of chlorpromazine was the first antipsychotic drug, and it really represents serendipity. And luck is good. I think that's great. So really, it was in the first half of the 20th century, a long time ago, so over 50 years ago, basically, there were drugs in a chemical class called phenothiazine. So they're a chemical class. They're now, you know, phenothiazines have potent antihistamine activity. They're actually just being investigated, and actually didn't know about histamine receptors either. They were investigated because they were sedatives. But it was discovered that basically if an agitated patient with psychosis, the positive symptoms they're trying to treat, they had at least the antihistamine phenazine that really didn't do anything to these patients. Another set of hypnotics, they don't treat agitated schizophrenia patients. It's not as simple as excitation and lowering excitation of the brain. But they found this one compound called chlorpromazine. It was made in France in 1950. And that compound, unlike the other phenothiazines, there was no molecular basis for the difference between chlorpromazine and the other phenothiazines. That drug showed basically specific effect in diminishing psychotic symptoms. That was shown way back in 1952. It's the structure of chlorpromazine on the right. Okay, so that just created a flurry of interesting things. In 1958, then, so it's serendipity, then iteration. So in 58, haloperidol was made, which had a pharmacology, so that now then they had characterized that the unique sedative properties of chlorpromazine in animals versus antihistamines, and you can do that in different models. Interesting, though, that haloperidol, people still believe that extrapyramidal symptoms, drug-induced Parkinson's, if your drug that basically, which was caused by chlorpromazine, was part of the efficacy of the drug. So if you did not see EPS, a drug wouldn't work, actually. And haloperidol is really good at causing drug-induced Parkinson's, EPS. And that fact, EPS was used to guide doses. So it was linked to efficacy. And then in 1966, a clinical paper came out on clozapine in schizophrenia. And clozapine, you know, showed to work, but the launch was delayed because clozapine did not cause EPS, which was thought to be needed. So it was not really well accepted, which I think is very, very kind of interesting. Agranulocytosis then was reported in 1975, and that really hurt the clozapine. But in the 1980s, it was discovered, brilliant work, that we now understood that dopamine receptor, dopamine antagonism, beautifully correlated with the clinical doses and the clinical effects of these antipsychotics. It was also discovered that these newer drugs, like chlorpromazine, also block serotonin receptors, 5-HT2A. So that was the beginning of pharmacology and maybe the new molecular sciences. Since then, a bunch of newer atypicals were launched that have in common D2 and 5-HT2A, and I've listed them there. And these are a big advance because they no longer cause EPS. I actually worked at a psychiatric clinic. I did my externship from pharmacy. It was very interesting. And that was still back in the early 70s, and there were a lot of people with tardive dyskinesias and EPS in the war that I was involved in. That was a big problem. That's basically been wiped off. Basically, that you don't see that anymore. I think sometimes antipsychotics aren't given enough credit for the advances they made in taking away at least those side effects, which are very, very problematic. They might have other problems that we're trying to overcome with the newer drugs, but they certainly were an advance over the earlier drugs that caused EPS. So the bottom line now is that all antipsychotics block dopamine receptors, and that basic mechanism of drug action hasn't changed since the discovery of clopromazine. And there's not really any clearly defined point of differentiation across the atypical antipsychotics. And then the point about function is, although you can control positive symptoms, getting patients to achieve better social and vocational function has been a problem. So what do you do? So how are we doing in basically following up with these types of discoveries? So basically, we're not doing very good. So first of all, it's now taking 10 to 15 years, and this number, 802 million, is very old. And it's over a billion now to put one medicine out there. And we have this pyramid we call. We think we make enough compounds at the bottom, 5,000 to 10,000, we'll get one. And we even went through a stage in drug discovery where we thought, now we can, you know, if we use CombiChem, we make a million compounds, then we can get 10 drugs, you know, statistically. And it just doesn't turn out to be that easy of a formula. But it does show you the amount of work and time and money that goes into discovering drugs. And it's not getting any easier. And if you look, the problem has been that we have put more money in. We have made more compounds. We have spent more money, but it hasn't translated into new drugs. So something is fundamentally not quite there yet. Or maybe there's a lag period in how we think about things and what we do. So then you ask the question, what can we do differently? How do we change this? So the thing that I think is, and actually at Merck and actually at Lilly, we created a group that really was fundamentally asked systems neuroscience is about taking all the new technologies and using it together to answer important questions. And I've just listed some of these new technologies. So every drug discovery effort, wherever it's at, can take these new techniques. And it's a way of getting in the brain and studying the brain that we couldn't do before. They're based on molecular sciences and technology. Some of the things probably invented at MIT, I would guess, many of these technologies. So it's really a good time. The other thing is, it used to be, and I was probably guilty of this, everybody sat in their office and came up with ideas, and it doesn't work that way anymore. If you have system neuroscience, maybe everybody's got to get in a circle and come up with ideas and implement them. And it's a different way of working. And I think things have changed for the better that way. But it's something to think about. So now we have expertise in all these capabilities. We're adding is we have better understanding, whether even if we fail, we have better understanding of our candidates and our science. We have better institutional knowledge. We can capture data and we can use it. We can manipulate it ways we never could before. We're hoping to execute cost-effective drug discovery by finding out what our drugs do earlier and then deciding to make the right investments. And hopefully that also gives you more flexibility. You might discover something you didn't think of if you study the fundamental neuroscience as opposed to, going after serendipity. So another way to think about this, and many companies are doing this, including my company, Merck, is to have an early development mindset. So the traditional method I showed you in the pyramid was the 10,000 compounds, one drug, it would be the traditional approach. And essentially, all you did is you made the drug, and then you did preclinical studies, phase 1 studies, and phase 2A trials that worked. You moved on to phase 3. Now, basically, what people are doing is saying, thinking about the disease, we're going to have a nice discussion on that here tonight, the disease, the target, and think about what are we trying to prove? What is the hypothesis? What's the proof of concept that we need about the molecule and about the disease we're trying to treat? So we've set up, you know, everybody has set up proof of concept modalities. They include everything from, you know, using rapid paths to clinical validation, although that can be a little harder in neuroscience than other areas. But we also have these enablers now, and we're really investing in these in the industry now and at my company. Experimental medicine is doing amazing things now, actually. Disease biomarkers are something that we're really working hard on with the ADNI group and Alzheimer's. I know Michael J. Fox is now working in that area. So if we could actually, in ophthalmology has some really good biomarkers that are actually there, which are pretty good. So that is a fundamental change. And then external collaborations. I think in pharma sometimes everybody's working, somebody told me, you're all working on the same things and you never talk to each other. And I think, well, I guess there's fewer pharma now, but we still have that mindset has to be of, at least on the enablers and in terms of partnerships with places like MIT or whatever. We need to think about where the value is at. It's no longer everybody working in isolation. Those are actually new ways that we're doing neuroscience. So the one thing I want to hammer on, which is, I'm sorry, it's very obvious, is I really am a big fan of imaging. This is a big technology in my company. In fact, I even hired the head of imaging in neuroscience. Now, Richard Hargreaves works for me. It's so important. And PET imaging has been the biggest advance, I believe, because most drugs in the clinic for neuroscience disorders, you didn't have any idea whether there was any drug in the central nervous system. Basically, you dosed up to maximum tolerated dose. You might measure plasma levels and see if they're as high as your animal models. We did different things. And in a way, you were testing molecules. You weren't testing ideas. So I'll give you an example. PET imaging allows you to test ideas and hypotheses and not just molecules. So I'm a fan of PET imaging for CNS target engagement. And actually, a valid proof of concept requires adequate receptor occupancy. That's just a pharmacological principle. And then you just ask, can sufficient occupancy be achieved at a well-tolerated dose? And if it can't, and it's mechanism-related, then you should work on something else. Is it worthwhile testing efficacy? And I think many drugs probably failed because they didn't have occupancy. And I have my own examples of that, unfortunately, or unknowns. So, basically, if you know that, then you don't need a new hypothesis. You just need a new molecule. And then, basically, if you can get to full occupancy with no efficacy, then do something else. And also, we use PET to help in dose selection for our pivotal efficacy trials to open the therapeutic window, and basically, we get more done with less. And this is, Richard gave me this slide. Imaging has it, and I'm not an expert in imaging. This is Richard's slide. It really has advanced. I can't keep up with it. There's molecular imaging. There's PET imaging. There's functional imaging. At the reception, I met some people that taught me more about imaging that I did, other things about imaging that I didn't know. And the ability to see in the nervous system and understand what is going on in disease and combine that with your drugs, I think, is one of the most powerful advances in the field of neuroscience. And I do believe there has been a lag. That technology has not been utilized to its full extent, and it hasn't been incorporated into the new model of how we do neuroscience. And just to give you an example, it's kind of like find the value, not test the hypothesis, not the compound. So you do your preclinical behavior, and then we'll do a PET in animals, and we'll move PET to guide dose selection and tell us how much occupancy we need to drive pharmacology in animal clinic. And then we actually look for pharmacodynamic effects if we can as well, looking at things like QEEG or things that show that there's a real change in the brain consistent with the mechanism in the right parts of the brain. We're also looking at platforms for cognitive disorders and how do you measure cognition, what are the instruments, how do healthy cognition compare to cognition in patients with disease. And essentially, if you have occupancy, you can do all that work, and you can know what you're doing. And then this is just a split. As an example, you might have a pro-cognitive agent that's alerting. And alertness alone can improve cognition. So you can essentially then start to learn how do you apply cognitive effects across different disorders. And right now, the history is things that improve cognition in Alzheimer's do not improve cognition in schizophrenia. We don't have anything that improves cognition in schizophrenia. And it's a way of breaking this up and studying this. And these are all basic areas of high medical need. So I think this example of a platform that you can use if you have PET occupancy and you're interested in cognitive diseases. Alzheimer's is a unique area. It's a very important area for many companies, including mine. And there, it's really interesting because you can do a lot of things now. So, and there's people have mapped out. So this is our map of today. It's a lot of risk in today, but 5 years from now, I think we're really going to be getting fundamentally to disease progression. There's a lot of studies now on functional imaging. People working on ligands for really measuring amyloid load in patients and looking at different forms of amyloid so you can actually get the drugs to the right patients and actually really test the amyloid hypothesis, maybe even earlier before the damage is done if you can identify patients. And there are all these groups which Merck, Lilly, Steve Paul, basically everybody participates, industry, academics, government, which includes ADNI, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, which I think is doing some phenomenal work. And that involves using these fluid biomarkers, which include tau, hyperphosphate, basically, and amyloid, and things like cerebral spinal fluid. So these will be a guide, kind of a roadmap for how we're going to do clinical studies down the road. Okay, so where do new drugs come from? So I'm a pharmacologist, and I'm big on neurotransmitters, so I'm going to apologize ahead of time for what I'm... Basically, that's one way which I think. And I think we haven't fundamentally tapped that, basically, fully tapped that. So I think about drugs come from new targets, and I like receptors and pathways that we understand and may be involved in pathophysiology or in symptoms. And I'm going to give you just briefly... my example of rational drug discovery example. So drugs which modulate glutamate for schizophrenia. So I talked about how the old drugs were discovered. Why would anybody ever look at glutamate for schizophrenia? And the first thing is that glutamate is what drives your brain. It's the major excitatory neurotransmitter. It basically drives all your synapses. It's countered with GABA in your brain, major inhibitor. And the problem is that actually, when I started working in this area in the 80s, the problem was that you had no ways to selectively modulate glutamate. There were basically two or three receptors, and they were onotropic, and it was thought that maybe they would cause side effects if you blocked those receptors. So how do you take something so fundamentally important and get selectivity? And I'll show you how you do that. And the second thing is, can you actually target pathophysiological processes with glutamate? If you understand the glutamate system, so that you stay away from physiology. And actually, some of the work that I was privileged to do, and actually work that's ongoing in the industry right now, is actually targeted at those two things. The fundamental advance was molecular biology. So went from 2 to 3 receptors to over 35 receptors. And I used to get asked by my research management, how are you going to selectively block glutamate? And then we start cloning all these things. And they said, how are you going to figure out what to work on? Which ones of these are important? But a lot of work has gone in this last decade in understanding the role of glutamate in pathophysiology and these different receptors and which ones would make the best drug targets. And I'm sorry, I won't go into that in depth, but you have ion channel linked receptors off to the left, and then these metabotropic receptors off to the right, where there are 8 subtypes. What distinguishes metabotropic receptors is, I'll show you in a second. So in a schematic way, and this is in a review article I wrote a while back, you have GABA and glutamate, which balance each other, and they really control basically being normal, physiology. And if you have too much glutamate or not enough GABA, then the balance is lost, and you have pathology, hypoexcitability, hyperexcitability. And basically, what was discovered through a lot of research that was done at many places using novel ligands, microbiology, is that the metabotropic receptors don't actually fundamentally control excitability directly. They are like they're homeostatic mechanisms that tell the synapse that it's maybe putting out too much glutamate or not enough glutamate. So they made really good drug targets because the data suggested they were not physiological. They were basically mechanisms that if you enhance them would basically help keep the brain out of trouble from being overexcited or underexcited. There's a huge literature on glutamate, And there's no disease that doesn't involve glutamate. And these are actually very good letters. Epilepsy, neurodegenerative diseases, pain, Parkinson's, schizophrenia, anxiety, substance abuse, drug withdrawal, cognition are all areas where glutamate pharmacology looks promising for these reasons. So what do you do? This is my cartoon, which I painstakingly drew in PowerPoint, and which is animated, which I put way too much work into this. But so here's your physiological stimulations. These mGlu receptors are presynaptic, and they monitor how much glutamate escapes the synapse. So physiologically, you release enough glutamate to activate your postsynaptic receptors, and if it's GABA, and actually these are on GABA and glutamate neurons, and that's where the function of the nervous system comes. You activate IGluRs or GABA-A receptors, and you get a response. But in pathological conditions, epilepsy, stroke are good examples, and there's evidence in schizophrenia, I'll get to, that in pathological stimulation, there's over-release. There's too much glutamate, or it's not handled properly. Glutamate escapes from the synapse, and you get too much excitation. And you might say in some of these heterosynapses, you might get too much inhibition. And I'll show you. And that activates this homeostatic mechanism, basically, to correct that. That's what mGlus do. So if you take a drug, like an mGlu2-3 agonist, and basically and it just sits there, now basically you've invoked this homeostatic mechanism constantly, and you can't overexcite these neurons. You can stabilize the synapse and maybe reverse pathophysiology. That was the basic hypothesis for how these work. So that was combined with the understanding that NMDA antagonists were discovered, as my colleague David Lodge at Lilly, that discovered that PCP, phencyclidine-like drugs, cause psychosis. And they block glutamate receptors called NMDA receptors. So this is the glutamate hypothesis of schizophrenia, which came about in the early 80s and was strengthened through other work. And glutamate antagonists, like NMDA antagonists, they cause psychosis in normal volunteers that you can't distinguish, exacerbate psychotic symptoms, and they disrupt this glutamate-GABA balance, and that actually manifests as a disconnect between the cortex and the subcortical regions, and animals run around. They don't do anything on a PAN scale. There's no running around on the PAN scale that I could see. But basically, that's what happens. You're disconnecting cortical, subcortical, and an animal's life basically is moving and being motivated, and you can measure that very easily. And that just represents an imbalance in glutamate-GABA balance. So how do you correct that? So this was the article that was referred to. And what you do to correct that is you give a drug. And there's a lot of drugs that will do this now, which are moving into clinical trials. The mGlu2-3 agonist, this was in this paper, was one example. And then the 2-3 knockouts, that went away. So animal runs around and you block. And drugs like olanzapine work in those models. And the knockout animals, the effect is basically still there with olanzapine. So basically, that was a way of, and then this was the data showing total PANs, PANs positive, negative, and global severity. So what this study said is that basically glutamate's involved in schizophrenia, and you can treat symptoms without blocking dopamine receptors in the way that I just described. And basically, so glutamate approach is an example of a good platform. So now we have clinical validation that you can do this, and there are other approaches. There's also genetic links between glutamate mechanisms and the pathophysiology. The idea is that maybe you can get better functional improvement if you get away from dopamine, and you can avoid all the dopamine-based side effects. And now there are multiple promising new glutamate-based approaches that do similar things and work in these models, and these are now being developed by many companies and are going to be tested in the clinic. So I think that's one example of rational drug discovery. So this is my last slide. So I just want to conclude. I think, you know, rational neuroscience drug discovery is now emerging, and the past is gone. The past was focused on a product for every depression syndrome. These were empirically derived, and they were iterative. Now we basically look at specific symptoms in these diseases like cognition and schizophrenia. We have allosteric mechanisms. We basically understand pathophysiology and genetics that we didn't know before. There was a lot of inward focus and multiple redundancies in drug companies. Now we have partnerships and alliances that enable the work we do to do these early development mindset There was a lack of translational capabilities, which I described. And there was just a focus on molecules, not on hypotheses and mechanisms. Now we're working to translate across species using molecular biology, and we're doing hypothesis-driven testing. And basically, and there are multiple avenues for drug development. We're working in partnership with a number of small companies and other companies, even large companies in consortia. We're doing early proof of biology and what I call true tests of targets, so we understand our drugs. All right. Thank you.